Hey, everybody. I just want you to listen to this, just for a second. Have a listen.
I love Puerto Rico. And she's in a lot of pain.
Yeah, you love Puerto Rico. She's in a lot of pain, and so are you, man. So are you, Louis. Now, in radio, in this case, podcasts, everything's not visual. Everything's about the sound. The loud sound, the soft sound. The sound of Luis telling you how much pain he's in, or Puerto Rico's in. The sound that tells you everything. And that other sound. The sound of silence. That silence in a big city by the lake, or on an island in the Caribbean. Just a few days ago, Democratic candidates for president made loud sounds in their debates. I'm going to let their message sit right there for the time being and let it ferment a bit. But the message of all the candidates, Democrats running for presidents, was perfectly clear. Let's distill it. They're not worried about America without money. There's plenty of money, they say. The problem is, for the Democrats, that it's in the wrong hands. And so they'll confiscate it and give it to their supporters and call themselves men and women of virtue. In one way, it sounds a lot like Chicago, another loud town of politics. And last week, check out these two sounds. One sound was silent when they pressed the button and the Chicago Tribune broke a story. Great reporters Jason Meisner and Ray Long, they're friends of mine and you've heard them here, with their fascinating tale that about a month ago, quietly, the FBI raided the home of one of Boss Madigan's top supporters and operatives, Kevin Quinn. The FBI took boxes of documents and computer equipment. And that was silent for week after week. And then when it broke the other day, it all got loud, and then there were the whispers. And another sound, not even a whisper, but the absence of sound, like negative space, from the man who, until a very short time ago, would never shut the bleep up. The same guy we started with at the top of this, Luis Gutierrez. Do you remember him? El Gallito, the little rooster, preening and screaming like some maniac, sometimes a spittle flying out of his mouth. Remembers him screaming at, he screamed at President Obama and at President Trump, both over immigration. Screamed at Daley, then he loved Daley. He screamed at his enemies, then he loved his enemies, and then everything stopped. The screaming stopped. That was something, wasn't it? For the first time in my life, Luis Gutierrez is quiet. He's been quiet ever since it became known that Alderman Danny Solis of the 25th Ward wore a wire for the feds. Very quiet. And I keep telling you that loud noises tell one story, but silence tells another story, the important story. Luis is now in Puerto Rico, I'm told. There was a wedding of a top Democratic political consultant, a vendor, a contractor with ties to a lot of people, and Chicago politicians were there. I'm thinking of Danny Solis at the bar, too, at the bar, at the hotel reception, and Luis running into him there at the bar. What do they do? They could talk tough, but really they're cowards. So I figure they just sit there and sip on something light and sweet, like a banana daiquiri, whatever those are like, and they'll sip in silence and think of all the times they talked to each other when Solis wore the wire. Going on several years now, just the two of them, talking with Rahm Emanuel, Luis and Rahm, and Danny and Rahm, and Alderman Anthony Beal, and Alderman Kerry Austin, and Alderman Pat O'Connor, and Alderman Ed Burke. You know, all the popular kids. The Tribune's Robert McCoppin is with us, talking about a fascinating Illinois pot story and what Colorado learned after rushing to legalize marijuana. And political lawyer and elections expert Bert Odelson on who might be a special prosecutor in the Jesse Smollett Kim Fox fiasco. Oh, and we'll talk about that alien invasion, not the one on the southern border with Mexico, but from outer space with Dr. Michael Wall. And Jeff Carlin is here as always, the master baker, relentless goalkeeper of the Palatine Celtic Soccer Club, retired, and currently the executive producer of The Rokan Show with Anna De Volantis. And I'm John Cass, husband, father, columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and proud member of that newspaper's editorial board. And you know where you are. You're listening to the sounds of silence, with predators all around, trying to grab your money. You're listening as if your future depended on it, because it does. You're on the Chicago Way, on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
All right, so now we're talking to the esteemed election lawyer of Illinois, Bert Odelson. Hey, Bert.
Hey, John. How are you?
How you doing? Jeff and I decided we wanted to get your views on a range of subjects, particularly, though, first, quickly, the Supreme Court. What do you make of that and how it applies to Illinois politics and the Chicago Way?
Well, just went to the conclusion in both the majority opinion and the dissent. And it is going to be fun to read. Not so much fun for us in Illinois, because it'll keep status quo as far as letting the General Assembly draw the maps any way they want, even with political considerations. The majority opinion was 34 pages and the dissent was 33 pages. And I've just read the first paragraph of the dissent, and Justice Kagan and the Clinton-Obama justices really gave it to the majority opinion. It says, for the first time ever, this court refuses to remedy a constitutional violation because it thinks the task beyond judicial capabilities. I mean, that's just the first sentence in the dissent. So I am very anxious to read this case and the implications to Illinois and then other states where Republicans control and gerrymander like we do in Illinois.
Well, obviously Kagan and the rest are liberal Democrats, and they're taking this as a political case. They want to stop Republicans from gerrymandering. But as we all know in Illinois, the Democrats do run things.
Things in Illinois, yeah.
And there's a certain guy that loves Palermo's Pizza on 95th, and so do I. And that and so do you. And we've all been there together, probably at the same time. And
probably.
And he draws the map.
That's correct. As has been the case, which again determines who's going to be elected from each district in Illinois and in other states. It's not exclusive to us. And the only way that's going to change is by constitutional amendment in Illinois or the individual states.
Well, one thing we can talk about is the amazing decision by Judge Tooman to go along with former Judge Sheila O'Brien, who was a guest on the podcast just the other day, and at length she described why she asked for a special prosecutor in the Captain Kim Fox, Jesse Smollett fiasco. And you know what? I just thought I'd ask a bunch of people who know things, who would make a good special prosecutor?
My thought was the former U.S. Attorney Fitzgerald. I mean, he's the one that pops into my mind as beyond reproach, smart, tough, even though I think he works at a big firm now, still. And Dan Webb, again, you mentioned it. I listened to your podcast. It was really, really well done with Judge O'Brien. I enjoyed it immensely, since I have been before Judge Bryan in the appellate court a good number of times and have always respected her. But I think Fitzgerald would be not only well-respected in whatever conclusions he comes with, but be tough on everybody. And that would be my initial pick.
And what are you looking for in character? I mean, obviously tough on somebody, but impartial. But is there a case to be made, or would you see in your mind somebody who's been worked the system for a very long time, someone outside of the sphere of, say, Cook County or out downstate or somewhere who has no attachment to anything here, just to keep that idea of impropriety and being fair? What quality there would you see?
That's the quality that he has, because he wasn't an insider here. He was an outsider, and he remained an outsider during his tenure as the U.S. District Attorney. Someone, either him or someone like him, even someone from another state, you know, I would a tough prosecutor, someone who knows the law. Not so much to say we want a indictment of Smollett, of anyone else within the state's attorney's office, but someone who will go through the process without any taint whatsoever. So the result this time would be whatever the grand jury decides, that's what the special prosecutor proceeds on. Whether it be indictments against Smollett or indictments or questions raised within the state's attorney's office itself.
If I were the judge and order the boss and the special prosecutor, I would say, Special Prosecutor Bert Odelson, first thing I want you to do is subpoena all of Kim Fox's personal cell phone records, and I want to subpoena Kamala Harris's records and Michelle Obama, because we've been going on this Michelle Obama Chen thing for a while. But you know what? It could be Kamala Harris, because I keep seeing all these pictures people are sending me, Bert, of Kamala Harris hugging Kim Fox, you know, big hug. And I'm wondering, and she was close to Jussie Smollett too.
The subpoena power is great. And yeah, she said on your podcast, John, and Jeff, the subpoenas and answering questions under oath is the key here, because as you know, you got to tell the truth or you're indicted for not telling the truth. So whether they subpoena text messages, emails, a good prosecutor will get to the truth. It's going to be very, as Judge O'Brien said, it's going to be very interesting. And I think for the first time in a while, we're going to get the real truth as to the process in a political and social media type of case.
We need the truth. The people need the truth of how that happened. But also, I need the truth on something else. There's a fundraiser coming up. Kim Fox has her big fundraiser. I was at the cigar store the other day. The guys who are there sit there with me know which one. And they listen to this podcast. And one of the guys says, you know, I'm not going to that fundraiser now. I'm ripping up my tickets because I don't want to be,
right.
I don't want to be on the list of giving money to Kim Fox. Can you see that happening?
I agree. It's going to have a dramatic impact on that. And whatever shakes out here, it's going to have a dramatic impact on running for a state's attorney. Who's going to step up and run for state's attorney?
I got an idea. The young man that Mark Brown celebrated in his column in the Sun-Times, the father is a billionaire and the young guy is a lawyer and a military veteran, might be one, but I'm thinking of a type, Bert, a type. You know, you mentioned Fitzgerald. How's this?
Yes.
I want a lawyer who's also a federal agent. I mean, not a U.S. attorney, maybe a postal, you know, one of those federal postal guys, or FBI.
Or FBI, yeah.
Who's also a lawyer.
Yeah.
Maybe has some limited experience with the county case, the county courts, before going to the FBI. There's got to be some people like this who know the system backwards and forwards and who understand corruption. But that kind of guy, would that person ever make it? Or would that person be stopped by somebody with a lot of bucks or somebody that wants to play the race card? You know what I mean? I think
the race card may have reached its peak and is dying, to tell you the truth. When you look at the court, when you look at where we are in Chicago, Cook County, and Illinois now, I don't think the race card means much anymore. You can play it, but I don't think it plays well. And I think the guy you mentioned, who we've talked to, would be an ideal candidate because of his background as a state's attorney and his financial background. Remember, some of the worst crimes we have now are financial in nature. Look at all the indictments.
I'm not supporting that man at all. I just noted that he got a lot of pub. I'm thinking of another type of guy, somebody that doesn't get the pub, somebody who's like a career L.E., law enforcement, lawyer, FBI, or postal inspector or something, who can do that, man or woman, maybe a woman.
And that could work, too. Again, you need a lot of money to run. That's the downside. You need a lot of money to run. And well-funded campaigns with a credible candidate beat not well-funded campaigns with a credible candidate every day. And you know that.
The man who understands the Chicago way, Bert Odelson, lawyer and expert of election law, thanks for being with us here today. Thanks,
Bert. Nice talking to you, John and Jeff. Thanks.
See you, buddy.
Thanks, Bert.
Up the magic dragon, lived by the sea, and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Hanalei. Little Jack.
And now we're talking to my colleague at the Chicago Tribune, Robert McCoppin. You can find him at Robert McCoppin, M-C, capital C-O-P-P-I-N, on Twitter and Facebook and all these other platforms. But the main thing is he's the go-to guy for what's happening with marijuana in our state. Bob, now that the governor has signed the first half of the, you know, get stoned, and then the next half will be the get out part. Well, he'll sign that later. What's going on?
I saw your column about that. Yeah.
What's going on with pot in Illinois, dude?
Well, it's the next big thing, John. It's coming. It's January 1st, and it's going to be legal. It's already here, but it will be legal, and it'll be much more widespread.
Right, and to that point, you're reporting. You looked at Colorado, who was by all accounts was the first player in the game, obviously, and really the ones who started rolling out, no pun intended, the idea of making a cash cow out of this crop and giving it to the masses. But it's not all dollar signs and, you know, fuzzy dreams. There are problems here. There is a black market, a piece of it. And what to your sense was that? Was people were really worried about that or dealing with that in Colorado?
Well, there's a whole host of issues in Colorado that have come up since legalization. And, you know, a couple of the biggest ones are driving accidents with people with marijuana in their systems and fatalities, hospital visits, emergency room visits and hospitalizations where marijuana is coded as one of the factors.
And that's being people either using high THC levels that are beyond what they're used to or what they should be and having bad reactions or getting themselves into an accident, i.e. in a car or even in their own home.
Right, yeah. There's and a lot of people with edibles that are trying it for the first time. You know, they eat the edibles, or kids who get into edibles, or adults who try it and nothing happens. They eat something, so they wait a half hour, nothing happens. They eat some more, and then it kicks in after an hour, and then they're way too high. And some people start freaking out. So,
and some of them are police officers, and they call 911. You've heard that call. People are like, I think I'm dying.
I think I'm having an overdose at the store with my wife.
Overdose of what?
Marijuana. I don't know if it had something in it. Can you please send rescue?
Did you guys have fever or anything?
No, I think we're dying.
Okay, how much did you guys have?
I don't know. We made brownies, and I think we're dead. Time is going by really, 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 really slow.
But here's the thing I got to worry about, the driving slow thing. I mean, you're on the expressway. All of a sudden, the car's going 30 miles an hour. Everyone's trying to dodge it. But now we're all, you know, I mean, with people being stoned, our expressways are what? It's going to be Mad Max out there, man. No?
Well, then it'll all be a slow speed chase, John. It'll be 25 miles an hour. And the thing with the, I should say, with the driving accidents, I mean, people are measuring, they have marijuana in their system, but it stays in your system a long time, like days, weeks even. So that doesn't prove that you're high just because you have THC in your system. But there's a correlation since legalization, the number of people. So there's no doubt more people smoking, but the number of, fatal accidents has more than doubled with people with marijuana in their system just in the last few years.
And speaking of that, I mean, that some of the numbers are pretty staggering, because one of the ideas and the arguments for this was that if we legalize it, then we take the power away from the drug dealers and the underworld that uses this and makes money off of it and then buys other drugs or weapons or works trade, moves into some other degree. But the reporting really kind of shows it's actually the other way, that now that there's more supply, that there are loopholes or there are nefarious means to get yourself on more marijuana, more and more potent marijuana, and then cut that and sell it at a higher rate. Can you speak to some of the crime numbers that are coming out, or at least the general idea of what people are seeing in law enforcement having to deal with this now?
I've seen some conflicting things on crime, but the number of charges for organized crime relating to marijuana has gone up substantially in Colorado. They're finding a bunch of illicit grows like on nationally owned land and out in the forest and stuff, which seems strange to me. I mean, I don't know why it would attract organized crime when you can sell it legally, but obviously the black market doesn't have to pay the taxes, and there's this large legal market that's established and that has overflow coming out of it. So far has been an attractive market. Now, hopefully, eventually it'll be like alcohol, where, you can grow it, at home or on your own, but everybody just goes to the store and gets it. And so they're hoping it'll, over time, will eliminate the black market.
So we'll have like craft pot.
Or artisan.
Artisanal pot.
That's right. And that's one of the things in Illinois, they protected the existing medical marijuana growers will get the first crack at the market. They will have exclusive ownership to the market. But then they're going to start licensing small craft growers who cannot be anywhere near the size of the existing growers. But it's easier to get going. It's just 5,000 square feet. That's like one big room. There is the thought that growers will be able to develop certain brands of strains of marijuana that people will like.
I'm a backyard gardener. I'm really good with tomatoes and cucumbers and so forth, radishes, and green leafy vegetables too. So can I do it at home? Can I grow them in my vegetable garden?
Sorry. Well, you may, but not legally, John. They were going to do that, but then police didn't like that, and so they cut that out. But the medical patients will be allowed to grow up to 5 plants each at home. So if you have a card for one of the 40 or so medical conditions, which actually they're expanding that also, and adding chronic pain as a qualifying condition. So there's going to be a lot more people who will qualify for that. How about you, John?
We haven't had this discussion at my house. My sons are college age and they're back and forth now, but we haven't had the discussion in my large extended, big fat Greek family to say, are we going to be a gummy bear pot family or a bong family? And I did that column last week about, the governor has that office, get stoned or get the bleep out of Illinois. But I'm wondering if that office should help people come to the, what you want, like an electric toker on your coffee table next to the National Geographics or Vanity Fair, depending, or do you just want like little papers, ZZ Tops or whatever they call them now?
Well, what are you going to do? Strange. I wrote about the Moms for Marijuana who advocated for legalization, and people are going to have to be deciding whether they're going to be having people smoke at their barbecues or consume in front of kids. It's only legal for 21 and over, and public health experts warn people, it's very bad for developing brains. It impairs learning and memory. It's bad for your lungs to smoke it, of course. It's bad for pregnant women. It's bad for fetuses. And so they warn people to keep it away from kids, keep it locked up, and make sure that they don't you don't have gummy bears lying around with THC in them.
We're going to have more kids smoking pot, becoming more and more stupid, unable to compete in the modern world, and they'll live in Illinois, and taxes will go up to pay for their maintenance, correct? That's how it looks to me. It'll be like China in the 1800s before the Boxer Rebellion, right? And Pritzker and his friends will make a lot of money until those Shaolin priests come down from the mountains of Illinois, wherever that is, and lead us to freedom.
Well, you know, they, fortunately, so far in, like, Colorado, for instance, they have not seen an increase in teenage use, but they have seen an increase in adult use. And you've got to wonder, and it's so early that it's hard to tell what's really going to happen over time. Yeah, it's, we're just a few years into it. And, you know, certainly alcohol, you know, I would expect it to become more and more like alcohol over time, where it's a legal market. But, of course, you know, underage kids are drinking all the time. Of course, they're, you know, people say, well, they're smoking already, too. Yeah, I would think it would be a lot easier to get if you can just buy it at the corner store and, you know, you're, you know, some older person here gets it for you and you know, just drives over from the corner store and hands it over.
And the tourism piece of it in Colorado is a huge thing, but you got to feel, and I know places like Michigan have legalized it, but they really haven't put in an infrastructure or written the laws to allow them people to buy it at the corner store just yet. And the growing is still a question for them. But places like Wisconsin, Iowa, Indiana, who surround us, they don't have it legalized. So is there going to be a tourism component to it for Illinois and Chicago specifically? I mean, is there an allowance for that?
Great restaurant town, man. We're right. The best restaurant town in the country.
And music. And music venues. There's a music.
I mean, come on. Go to... would Kerry Nahabedian, Bob, allow people to smoke pot before tasting her delicious, you know, creations at Brundeal? I mean, or the new place? I don't think, maybe not. You know, who knows?
Well, yeah, there will be a tourism bump from this. You know, yeah, we're already getting a bunch of tourists, but you may not smoke legally in public. They are allowing, they weren't initially going to do it, but I guess they ended up allowing smoking lounges. But you won't be able to light up, you know, at your normal restaurant just like with a cigarette. So you'll have to do that on your own somehow before you go to any of these fancy restaurants that I can never afford to go to.
So then it will be. The state, in its wisdom, is already directing the future marijuana consumer into the gummy bears, right? Because you just pop a gummy bear, go to the bar, have a drink or whatever, and then gorge yourself on bad pasta, like with meatballs as big as your head, and you know those franchises that have the horrible pasta, right?
Right. Yeah, that's one big reason for the edibles is people can consume them inconspicuously or take them with them, and just pop them in their mouth, or vaping also. People, you know, can vape quickly and put it back in their purse or whatever, or backpack. And certainly if you go to Colorado, I mean, people do smoke in public. You can smell it growing outside the grow houses. I know people have complained about the smell from the smoke. So it is out there, and it will be in Illinois.
Bob McCoppin, you can find him always at the Chicago Tribune and on Twitter at Robert McCoppin, McCoppin. Bob, what's the next step? What's the next step for you to write about marijuana? What's the next thing? What's the next story that you're working on?
Well, I'm going to be writing about psychosis. There's a couple of studies that show a correlation between marijuana use and psychosis, which is, you know, basically a divorce from reality, a break from reality, and But there is no the cause hasn't been proved. So the jury is out. There's still a lot of debate over whether that whether the marijuana is causing that, or whether it's people who are already prone to mental illness who happen to be smoking. But otherwise, I mean, as far as the new marijuana law, I mean, the licensing has to be done now. The state regulators have to come up with all the rules, and people are going to have to come up with a bunch of money if they want to get into this business now. There is going to be a big part of the law is this social equity component that will provide money for entrepreneurs, for minority entrepreneurs in areas disproportionately affected by the war on drugs, as they say, which is primarily like the West and South sides,
right.
Where, you know, blacks were arrested at like five times the rate of whites for marijuana, even though their rates of usage, according to surveys, are about the same.
That's nice. So, that's nice. So we're going to have... Yeah. The street gangs, which are politically active now and help elect state senators and aldermen, the street gangs will now be getting a piece of their own action, competing against themselves. Amazing.
It is, you know, people with convictions, that's another big part of the law, is expungement for people who had low-level marijuana convictions, and that they also get favoritism then in getting these licenses.
Robert McCoppin of the Chicago Tribune, you want to read about psychosis and marijuana? He's the man to look for. So, and I agree, that's a very important component of this, and probably the most important of all. So thanks a lot.
And, you know, most people, the vast majority of people can smoke marijuana without a problem, just like most people can drink alcohol without a problem. But there's going to be a minority of people who get addicted and have serious problems from this.
As one person who doesn't do anything halfway, I have to tell you, I'm glad you're writing that. Thanks, Bob. Thanks, Bob.
All right, thanks, John. Thanks, Jeff.
Bye, buddy.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
Nanu!
All right, and joining us now is none other than Dr. Michael Wall, Space.com senior space writer, to talk about what is going on in the world around us. And by world, I mean universe. And by universe, I mean everything we can see.
Or not see.
Or not see. Dr. Wall, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time. And I got to say, are UFOs aliens, and are aliens among us?
I don't think that you can say UFOs are actually aliens. That would be that's a possibility that a lot of people like really want to jump to, but it's a pretty big logical leap to go from I don't know what that thing is to it's an alien spacecraft. So I think that the kind of evidence bar for that has to be pretty high. I mean, just based on what a huge deal it would be. And there are a lot of other kind of like more realistic explanations that you should go to first before you kind of jump onto that last one. I mean, it's really exciting and it's tempting to do that, but yeah, it's not really warranted in my opinion.
Now, Doctor, you deal in science. I deal as a columnist in politics. And one thing I know that depending on your politics, you will either deny science, like there are not only two genders, you know what I mean? Or you will...
Yes.
Embrace it, the global warming, global cooling, whatever fits your politics. And given that, Dr. Wall, I have to tell you that when I'm watching cable news on a regular basis, like 24/7, and I never leave the television, I keep seeing crawls under the screen, chyrons, telling me about lawmakers being briefed about UFOs. And to me, I know what you're saying, but to me it's like prepping us for the inevitable that, yes, there are aliens, and just trying to walk us slowly to that point so we can deal with it psychologically. Isn't that how you would do it?
I think that those are kind of two separate kind of questions. I mean, I do think that there are aliens out there somewhere. I think it's just such a huge universe, and there's so many habitable planets. You know, we've just learned over the past few years that about 25% of all of the stars in our galaxy seem to be actually host like a possibly Earth-like planet. You know, one that's rocky and about the right distance from its star to host liquid water and stuff like that. So that number, that means there's probably at least 50 billion habitable planets in our galaxy. And for us to think that we're the only planet that has life, I think that's just kind of crazy. That's just a crazy number. There's got to be something else out there. But I don't know. I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean that we've been visited in this brief kind of sliver of time that we've been able to kind of like record things and take videos and kind of write stuff down. You know, that's another leap. And I mean, I don't know. I don't think that we're being prepped for that announcement. I do think that there is a kind of change in the culture and people are more accepting of the possibility that there are aliens out there and that it's not as taboo as it used to be for a scientist or a politician or just a general person to say, you know, I think that there is something out there. I mean, you can get tarred with the crazy brush quite like you used to just because of all these recent finds showing us how big the universe is and how much there is out there. And how many planets there are that could host life. So that's a big change that I see anyway. That's been happening over the past few years. And people are more accepting of the possibility.
Right. And in that vein, it's almost become more mainstream because it used to be, you know, the people who said, oh, I experienced aliens or I saw aliens were, generally speaking, you know, people who lived on the fringes of society, who were people who weren't necessarily the most credible kind of witnesses. But now, as you know, technology, the ability to share thoughts and experiences has essentially connected everybody. You get airline pilots, you get amateur pilots, you get astronauts, you get Navy pilots who say, yeah, hey, there's something going on. I'm seeing something that does not make sense, that I don't know anything about. And as to John's point, what sparked this is that it feels like, and obviously the science, you know, there's a whole idea of civilizations have a push point where we're either any civilization, no matter what planet or what solar system or galaxy they're in, that they get to a point where technology and then, of course, native, you know, own self-interest run head to head. And you get things like nuclear wars or cataclysmic events like global warming, things that essentially destroy a civilization and would then limit or curtail their ability to travel long distances across entire universes. But that being said, we really feel like it just keeps getting, it's more and more prevalent and more mainstream, thus leading to people believing that, hey, maybe these things have just been covered up so well that they're out there, and in the next few years, it's going to be like, yep, we were kidding all along. This has been going on, but we weren't sure if they were friendly or foe yet.
Put the glasses on, the sunglasses, you will see them among us, right?
Right.
that's a really good point about how, what you said, like, once you get to a certain point technologically where you get, like, the ability to start actually thinking about going to other star systems and trying to colonize the galaxy, like, you've reached a point where you are very easily able to destroy yourself via your technology if you're not careful. That's a really good point. And that's one possible explanation for why we don't have solid evidence of any intelligent aliens or like any kind of aliens, is because, yeah, maybe like most of them off themselves once they reach a certain point, which we seem to be going down that path too, based on how we've just barely avoided total annihilation via nuclear war a couple of times. We're like definitely changing our like climate in a pretty dramatic way. So these things are already happening here. Maybe we're on the path towards self-destruction too. But and it's a good point, the whole acceptance thing. I mean, the like U.S. Navy has recently issued new sort of guidelines to their pilots that encourage them to actually report these things. So that speaks of like a broader acceptance of this kind of open-mindedness, even in an organization that's like, I mean, pretty like conservative ideologically. You know, I mean, military people don't accept change super fast because it's kind of dangerous to actually do that. So the fact that you see that coming from the military, that's a pretty big deal. That they're like, well, we should figure out what these things are. Let's not just assume everybody who sees them is an idiot or is crazy. So that's a pretty big deal.
Well, if these craft been described to you? How do you understand them to be? The super fast craft that, you know, these pilots and fighter jets cannot track. They're so fast.
Yeah, they're basically described as these kind of super fast moving blobs that you can't really get a handle on. They just zip all over the place, and they don't have any like visible exhaust plumes, so it's like unclear how they're moving so fast. And they're just really mysterious. And I mean, I'm not saying that there's no chance that they're alien spacecraft. I don't want to say that. I mean, I I think it's really important to be open-minded and not to say that that's impossible, because people really don't know what these things are, and it's important to keep an open mind about it. But it's just, it's interesting from my perspective that all UFO sightings, they like kind of tend to push the technology. So, I mean, to its very limits. So we never get a good look at these things. I mean, depending on where our technology is at the time, whether it's just like regular cameras in the 40s and 50s, or now with these like high-tech instruments on these fighter jets, they're always just capturing these fleeting glimpses of UFOs and never able to get a good look. And that's sort of suggestive that maybe it's an instrument issue, or we just, I don't know. I do keep an open mind. I'm not saying that there's no way they could be aliens, but it just seems more kind of likely to me that there's an instrument issue or it's some phenomenon that we don't know. But yeah, you can't necessarily jump to say that they're aliens. It's just a really big kind of leap to actually make.
Or it could be Chinese technology. And their fighter planes can destroy us at a whim.
Yeah, and in Dr. Wall's pieces, he explains, lays that out, that the idea that, you know, in the 30s and 40s, you had geographically localized reports of aliens that a lot of times tend to coincide with government installations, you know, places like Roswell, places like the testing stands, places where you would expect the military to testing things that nobody has a knowledge of or nobody has access to just because of the way government works. But now in recent years, to one of Dr. Wall's points is that you see a lot of these things on the fringes of American airspace where they wouldn't be traceable, or they are harder to track, or they're only going to be seen by one-off jets or two, you know, couples of jets who are just doing regular surveillance or patrolling. And that leads to the idea or the probable hypothesis that these are Chinese, Russian, who knows, other aspects of, or other military hardware. Extrapolate on that a little if you could.
That's one of the possible explanations, that it is some kind of secret military technology, either that like we're developing and, you know, even some people in the military aren't aware of what other branches are doing. And that wouldn't be uncommon. I mean, we all know that like the military develops things that are super secret and they don't tell us about it until they want to. Or it's possible, like you were just saying, that it could be some sort of adversary craft, like some like reconnaissance craft, that's doing some secret stuff, and they actually represent advanced technology that we're not aware that like another nation has. That's a real possibility. And just to kind of go back to another like reason, what we're talking about, are we being prepped for a big announcement? Does the military or like does the government know, and they've kept a secret all this time that we've been visited? I personally would think that would be a really hard secret to keep, just based on how important that information is and how valuable that information is. If like it seems like if like somebody wanted to get that out, they would become very rich very quickly or very famous very quickly. So it's just it would just be hard to keep a gigantic secret like that. I mean, in my opinion, that's just another reason to suspect that we aren't being prepped for a big announcement, a big secret announcement the government has been keeping like under wraps for decades or something like that.
Be that as it may, incidences of methane gas found on Mars suggest to me organic material and therefore life. And I mean, it just leads me to wonder. How about you?
Yeah, no, I think Mars is really interesting, and that's something that we've been just discovering in the past few years. NASA's Curiosity rover has kind of rolled through these sort of methane plumes on three different occasions now, and that's a pretty big deal because almost all methane in Earth's atmosphere is actually produced by some form of, most of it's actually from like single-celled organisms, you know, but some of it's from cows, obviously famously cows farting and that sort of thing, or actually birthing. Rolling through plumes of this methane in Mars's atmosphere, it suggests that there like could be something on Mars going on underground. And Mars does have underground water. We already know that. And we also know Mars used to have like oceans and lakes and streams back in the ancient past. Those have all dried out, all that surface water dried out, but there is underground water. And if it's tempting to think that if there was ever life on Mars, it just retreated into those aquifers underground and is still going. And that's sort of the stuff we were like talking about earlier, you know, some of these things that we've learned in the past few years about how much habitable real estate there is out there. You know, there are multiple worlds in our own solar system that might have life today. I mean, and that's, and Mars is actually one of them. And then there are some icy moons in the outer solar system that have subsurface oceans. They have ice shells, and underneath those ice shells are huge oceans. They're salty. They seem to be, fairly similar to Earth's oceans. So they could have something swimming around in it. And those sorts of things, it's really exciting. Now, even our own solar system might have alien life. And then you kind of extrapolate beyond that to the billions and billions of other planets, other systems. It's just mind-boggling how much there is out there. I mean, the possibilities are, like, almost endless.
And 2 points to that the idea that there is, you know, that we're looking at Saturn as being, you know, one of these places where it has tons of moons, and it's going to be, or Jupiter, and these moons that have, like, they know there's frozen liquid, and the theory is that there is the right makeup, concoction, to be some sort of organisms living below, way below levels that ice, and NASA is working towards that. So we're on the precipice of actually proving that there is some form. We're not talking, walking, you know, signing their name, flying across the universe, life, but there is some sort of life in our own galaxy, our own solar system, that is, you know, reachable and observable, which will prove then that the aliens are in abundance outside of what we can see. And to your point, I don't think people understand this, that the odds, just the odds alone of two intelligent intergalactic species coming across each other is so low. I mean, aliens could have been on this planet, but they could have been here millions of years ago, because there's such a never-ending supply of time and the happenings that make the galaxy run, like stars being born and imploding and colliding and all these things, that the likelihood that they would find us or we would find them is so infinitesimally small, that it to be that lucky that, oh, I'm the person who saw it, that would mean you would be the luckiest human being ever existed.
Yeah, that is a really good point. You know, people don't have a great conception of the time and space that we're dealing with, just because it's so far beyond our everyday experience. But, you know, we've been actually looking for some sign of intelligent life for about 60 years, right? That's when all these, like, SETI searches first started, back in 1960. And so that's the little sliver of time that we've been really hunting in a systematic way. And it hasn't been well-funded, and it's not systematic, actually, because there's only a few people doing it. But yeah, so if you compare that little sliver of time with the, like, 13.8 billion year old universe, and then which spans, like, billions and billions and billions of like light years, the chances that we're going to overlap in time and space with another intelligent civilization are really, really small. We would have to be incredibly lucky. And then there's the motivation question too. Given those huge distances, I mean, chances are, if there is something else out there that kind of overlaps with us in time, it's probably going to be pretty far away. And how would they know about us, first of all? And second of all, what would motivate them to come here? And then you get into kind of scary scenarios, though. They want to enslave us and steal our resources or something. So it's not just that they have to exist, but they have to actually want to come and see us, or maybe they're just everywhere and they're colonizing every aspect of the galaxy and they just stumble across us. But there's, like, a motivation question too, in addition to the do they exist question.
And just to read it, to kind of put a pin in that point too, the idea that we've only been searching, or even technologically been able to broadcast signals through radio frequencies, you know, less than 100 years in real usable force, that those signals take, on just that fact alone, you know, they take hours to just leave our solar system. I mean, and we're not talking speed of light from stuff that we're doing, because it's radio waves and they're slower. So then put that beyond our solar system. I mean, for any civilization who would be in reach of us, they'd only be discovering the signals from us now. I mean, that's the closest inhabitable planet is like 12 light years away, which is, you know, it's almost a third of what time we've been putting out signals that would even be, you know, understandable or even be recognizable as being an intelligent race.
Oh, please, Jeff. Yeah. This is like the people that said the air would be sucked out of the train car if we went 35 miles an hour. Dr. Wall, I must ask you, I thank my friend Jeff for forcing me to take a step back. But I have to ask you, in the sort of the fashion of a medieval knight asking you, does if a duck floats and it is wood, therefore it's a witch and we shall burn her. What do you make of the story out of Pascagoula, Mississippi, where a historical marker has been placed near the river where two men in southern Mississippi said they were abducted by aliens in 1973. News outlets report the city. These officials of Mississippi support their claim, and I haven't studied it enough to know if they've been probed, you know, sexually by the aliens. That happens sometimes. But what do you make of the general thing?
Maybe I mean, I don't know enough about that either to really comment on it. I mean, alien abduction, but like just in general, when you talk about like the whole like what's motivating them and why would they come here, the alien abduction thing. I mean, I don't know. It just adds another layer to the like what are they doing? The kind of question which you have to ask yourself. I mean, if like aliens, if these UFOs are actually alien spacecraft, then what are they doing here? They're kind of zipping around. They like make it here across these huge distances, which requires really advanced technology, and then they just zip around in our sky for a while and don't do anything. That's weird to me because it seems like if they have the technology to get here, then they'd have the technology to cloak themselves but kind of remain unseen if they wanted to. And if they wanted to be seen, you'd think they would show themselves to more people. But then you kind of add another layer of that. They're coming here to probe us, like sexually and stuff like that. That's just, I mean, I don't know. I think that there are a lot of psychological things that go into those reports too, and a lot of them like occur on when people are just waking up from dreams, and so it's hard to kind of tell what's reality and what's a dream. And but it's just really hard because you don't want to go into like each individual case because you don't know that person, you don't know their experience, you didn't see what they saw, so you can't really judge them. I mean, you can just kind of make broad generalizations about how these things usually occur, but it's sort of like a trope, I guess, that we're so interesting that like other species that are far more advanced than us would want to come here and inspect us and figure out how we tick and invade us sexually. It's just, it's sort of a self-aggrandizing concept, actually.
Yes, and to that point, the anthropomorphism of the accounts is a red flag to say, okay, there's something else. You know, this is either a cry for attention or a cry for help or some other thing. Most of these situations, it seem like they're just too much a human vein of like what I feel like I would be abducted. Oh, they would probably stick something in the places I don't want them to stick things, and then I start there, and that's in my story. And so it just doesn't. Nothing adds up to a sum of they're here.
The common conception of like what an alien looks like is worth commenting on too. You know, everybody has an image in their head of like a big headed alien with these big eyes and long fingers and two arms, two legs, and they look kind of like us, but not so much that it's not creepy. And that's like a sci-fi construct, you know, and that's pretty psychological too. You know, we like want to envision things or deal with things that we are sort of familiar with. So we sort of make aliens as familiar to ourselves as we can and still make them exotic. I mean, if you want to think about what aliens actually look like, it's all over the map. I mean, based on the, like how many different or what the different environments are like in all these different planets, and it's just really hard to say what they would actually look like. And if they actually made it this far and came here and they've colonized the galaxy and all this, then they're probably not biological life forms at all. They're probably machines. I mean, there are a lot of scientists who take that view that if you're an advanced civilization and you've been around for a few billion years, you've probably made the jump from flesh to circuits. Like, I mean, that's probably part of that evolution. We're already starting to do that a little bit. We're already going bionic a little bit with our implants that help paralyzed people move their limbs again and so on and so forth. We're just in the really early stages of that. But, I mean, give us a million years, and, I mean, we actually might take that route too if we survive.
Dr. Mike Wall, thanks so much from space.com. PhD and of course, evolutionary biology, which is very important when you're trying to think about aliens and what we are. I appreciate you. Where can people find more about you if they'd like to learn more?
Well, yeah, they can go to space.com, or they can go to, I mean, I don't tweet all that much. I am on Twitter, Michael D. Wall. And yeah, people can actually check out a book that I wrote called Out There. It's about the search for alien life. It just came out this past November, and it talks about a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about for the past 25 minutes or so. So
I can't wait to read it, and I must say in closing, thanks for being here, and Klaatu Barada Nikto. Thank you, Doctor.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Now, you know, the Chicago way is growing leaps and bounds every day. It's the hottest thing over here at WGN Plus, and we want to even get bigger, okay? We want the reach to get larger. We want people to hear us all over, not because they have to hear my beautiful voice or Jeff's, you know, brilliance on matter science and everything else, because you need an alternate voice, and we're the ones who are giving you that alternative voice. A republic needs it. And they need us. I believe it. So find us on iTunes. Subscribe for free. Write us a kick-ass review. Tell your friends. Do it on Facebook. Find us on Facebook when I post Jeff posts the podcast. Share it, please. Tell your friends to listen. It's the greatest thing. You listen to the Chicago Way when you're having lunch. You plug it in your cell phone. You listen. You can put your earbuds on. You could, you know, eat some bacon buns and drink some unsweetened iced tea and enjoy yourself. And today's episode, I just love talking to Dr. Michael Wall, senior writer of Space.com, and Robert McCoppin of the Chicago Tribune, and his talk about the politics of pot and what he's writing about in the future, which is psychosis and legalized marijuana. And Bert Odelson, the Illinois election lawyer, weighing in on the Supreme Court and who should be the next special prosecutor in the case of Kim Fox and Jesse Smollett. And Jeff Carlin, of course, executive producer of The Rokan Show with Anna DeVellantis, and me, John Cass, husband, father, columnist for the Chicago Tribune, bumped off the Laura Ingram program. Maybe I'll go back on. By the time you hear this, maybe I'll have been on it. It was humiliating to be bumped, but, you know, that's what happens. And you, I want to thank you. Again, we don't do this for money. I love doing it. Jeff likes doing it. We don't do it for fame or riches. We do it so that you have something to listen to when you're having lunch with the earbuds and the bacon buns in your mouth. Thanks for being here on another edition of the Chicago Way.